I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey everyone, Jeremy Scheinwald here with another episode of Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast. Our podcast is produced by, wait for it, Venture for America, a fellowship program for enterprising recent college graduates who launch their careers as entrepreneurs and help revitalize American cities. After 5 weeks of training, VFA fellows spend 2 years in the trenches of a startup in an emerging U.S. city where they learn how to contribute to a high-growth business. Afterwards, VFA provides the mentorship, network, and resources fellows need to become entrepreneurs. To learn more about Venture for America, to consider an application even, or to support our work, you can visit ventureforamerica.org. I've been hosting the podcast for getting close to a year now. We're over 40 podcasts deep. I have a day job as a founder and president of Mission Driven Group, but this podcast is a real passion project for me. I hope you are becoming a loyal listener. Please take a moment to like our show on iTunes, and you can now follow me on Twitter at Jeremy Scheinwald. Our guest today is Matt Breimer, a Yale graduate who has started a few businesses with past guest Brad Hargraves, and we owe Brad a thanks for connecting us with Matt. Matt started Aloysius, an antique furniture reseller, while a student at Yale. Then he leapt from the past to the future, co-founding Pick Teams Go Cross Campus, a social gaming platform that engaged tens of thousands of college students, all competing against each other. When Pick Teams Go Cross Campus wrapped, Matt launched General Assembly, which was initially a co-working space, but also brought forth an era of alternative skill development and private courses that basically rang in the era of coding classes, tech career transitions, and inexpensive tech startups. I'm almost exhausted reading this, but Matt has a wellspring of energy. In his spare time, he launched Daybreaker, a morning movement that has turned into an early evening movement as well. Think inclusive rave, where the alcohol and other substances are replaced by juice, yoga, and dancing. I'm really looking forward to this interview. We welcome Matt Breimer to the podcast.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
All right, Matt, so thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
So we talked with your collaborator, Brad Hargraves, about Aloysius when he was here, and he mentioned that it was kind of like a fortuitous experience in his life that made him realize that he had the heart of an entrepreneur. You went on to like start a bunch of businesses together, but was this the entrepreneurial moment for you, or were you always did you always know that you were going to be starting things?
So, Aloysius was a great learning experience. It was the first real true business that I had built and started, and we learned a ton about customer service and sales and inventory and supply management and e-commerce and all these things. But I would say my entrepreneurial journey and inspiration really got started from a younger age. Growing up, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. Both my parents are small business owners and entrepreneurs themselves, and they're both very creative people. So I was fortunate, and my parents never, you know, had a preordained career path for me. You know, you go be a lawyer or go be a doctor or, you know, go into corporate America or anything like that. They really encouraged my creativity and encouraged me kind of pursuing my own path. But I was always very inspired by their entrepreneurial journeys. My mom is a graphic designer, has her own graphic design firm, and my dad runs an architectural signage business, and they make large-scale signage and big public art installations and kind of everything in between. And and they, you know, both had professional lives that were them making things and building things and running their own businesses. And I was just like the freedom and the creativity of what they were doing, and looked up to them in that way. So, you know, I did a little bit of like freelance video production growing up in high school, and some other small. I used to make and sell T-shirts and that kind of thing. But it was really once I got to college and got to spread my wings a little bit that Brad and I started Aloysius Properties, and you know, just found an opportunity with the Yale University Library was undergoing renovation, and they were selling off all these old card catalogs for nothing. And we saw, hey, maybe we should get a U-Haul, go get one of these things and bring it back to our dorm and put it on eBay. And we did, and it ended up selling for 20 times the amount that we bought it for. But you know, we told the story. It was we positioned it well. We rather than this just being an old piece of furniture that was from an old renovation, this was a piece of history. You know, this had a story to it. This was decades and decades old in one of the world's most historic libraries. The storytelling and the framing and positioning and adding some kind of human element to this just, you know, static piece of furniture, I think is what made us realize that, hey, you know, building a business is a lot more than just the physical product. You know, it's the story that goes into it. It's the brand, it's the communication, it's the vibe, it's the whole kind of sum of the parts that really makes it work.
It's interesting you just said we told the story, because that kind of leads me to my next question. When you started together, you and Brad, and I think a couple of other co-founders started Pick Teams Go Cross Campus, which was described as like a risk-like social gaming platform. And you know, you raised some money, but this is 2007. Like, this isn't quite the world of college kids, you know, starting, you know, or I mean, I guess maybe Facebook was around then, but it wasn't quite what we know it to be now. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, what was the pitch for? You raised, I think, about $375,000. What was the pitch that you gave investors? Like, yeah, give a bunch of, you know, young guys who've been selling card catalogs your money, and we're going to build a social gaming platform.
Yeah, it was definitely early days. You know, we ended up, over the course of the life of the company, we ended up raising almost $2 million in venture capital. But that first seed infusion was from some people who were in the Yale alumni network. You know, both Brad and myself and our other co-founders were involved in the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute. And so the university was starting to realize that, oh, some of our biggest donors, some of our biggest success stories beyond, you know, presidents and CEOs are actually entrepreneurs. And so they thought, you know, we should actually start to cultivate more of an entrepreneurial community within the undergrad world ecosystem. And so, you know, if I recall, you know, going to angel investors, this was still the early days of social media. Facebook was just a couple years old, you know, so it was still pretty nascent. I think a lot of people didn't really understand what was possible with social media, but what they did understand was we were going to take real-world college and sports rivalries. You know, take the rivalries between the Ivy League schools, take Duke versus UNC, Stanford versus Berkeley, right? These real-world offline social motivators, not only in college rivalries, but also in sports rivalries at large. And these are very, very powerful social forces that just hadn't yet been captured online. And I think with the timing, we hit, it was interesting because we were just starting to see Facebook start to take off. We were just starting to see social games. You know, Zynga was a small team doing social gaming. We were a small team doing social gaming. And actually, I remember we talked to Zynga early on about potential partnerships, and ultimately we realized, you know, we decided it didn't make sense to work together at that time. Zynga went on to become Zynga. You know, we ended up raising some money, building out a team, and a couple years later ran out of cash and had to close up shop, and you know, it was a failure. So I always kind of look back and think, like, if we had actually partnered with Zynga, you know, maybe it would have been a different story, you know. But you know, fate be as it may, you know, I think ultimately looking at the longer perspective, that company, Go Cross Campus, and then eventually we changed the name to Pick Teams, that company had to fail, and we had to kind of learn something from that in order for us to move on and go on to kind of focus on bigger and better things, you know, things that move the world forward, like education and community and everything else that we're building now. So it was, in some ways, looking back, it was fortuitous that that company ended up failing, even though at the time, you know, it was a pretty dire situation.
So you raised $2 million, and like, looking back, do you feel like you were good stewards of that fund, like really responsible? Were you miserly stewards of other people's money, or were you prudent, or were you wild?
I mean, as prudent as what were like late teens and early 20 somethings,
right?
You know, could be being first time entrepreneurs. You know, we made a lot of first time founder mistakes. We had 5 co-founders, which I don't recommend anyone having 5 co-founders. It's just too many cooks in the kitchen. You know, I remember my senior year, I would get up on every Friday, take the early Metro North in from New Haven, Connecticut, into New York City. We had an office there, and I would work a full day as a, you know, full-time adult entrepreneur, and then that evening go back to Yale and go back to being a college student. So made a lot of first-time founder mistakes, you know, anything from like hiring, you know, the wrong people to spending the wrong ways on marketing and whatnot. I think we did the best we could, you know. It was a fantastic education. You know, our investors knew that they were investing in a startup started by, you know, college students. And, you know, some of the best companies are fit that model, and a lot of failures fit that model, you know. So luckily we have good relationships with all of them, and it was nothing ever too catastrophic, you know. The recession didn't help, though. That definitely hurt our continued fundraising aspirations.
Right. I'm always interested in this, like when someone hits the wall, when someone says it's time to let it go.
Yeah.
How did you really know that you had exhausted? I mean, you had tens of thousands of users on mm-hmm. on the platform. Mm-hmm. I mean, these days that would be like awesome. People are like, wow, you have no revenue. You have tens of thousands of users. Wow, we want to give you even more money.
Yeah.
How did you like? Did you really? Was it like, look, we've talked to everyone, and mm-hmm. there's just not another person out there to talk to. Like, how did you just say, look? I mean, this is the line. That's it.
Mm-hmm. So it was largely had to do with the amount of money that we had in the bank account, and just seeing that continue to go down and down. We ended up taking a bridge rounds just to have some money in the bank to pay our team, pay our staff, and keep the lights on. But ultimately, we were trying to raise another round of capital after our first one in late summer of 2008 into spring of 2009, which, if you remember, was the most terrible time, you know, to be raising money in the economy, and everything was falling apart. And, you know, back in, if you would zoom back to 2007 into early 2008, a lot of the common wisdom was, oh yeah, focus on product, focus on growing your user base, don't worry about revenue, revenue will monetize once you're at scale, and all of that common wisdom. And then if you zoom forward to now or the last couple of years, that kind of is the common wisdom again. The problem was that when the recession was really hitting, a lot of investors were tightening up their belts, and a lot of investors were saying, all right, we want to see revenue, turn on monetization. The problem with our market was, you know, we were targeting college students, and college students just don't have a lot of disposable income. They're not young enough that they can have access to their parents' credit cards. They're not old enough such that they have disposable income from jobs and they're making money and they can spend more. They're kind of in this strange situation. So our, you know, target revenue model was advertising, but we weren't operating at enough scale to really have enough advertising to really make a difference. And so a lot of the investors that a year before had said, focus on scale, don't worry about revenue yet, now change their tune when the economic, you know, global macroeconomic situation looks different. And we're saying, we want to see revenue. We weren't able to generate the kind of revenue that they wanted to see. Our money was dwindling. You know, we tried to keep it together, but we eventually had to close up shop and basically ran out of cash.
Was it too soon? Like, could that model be viable today, or was it just like that model is just not viable?
I think the concept would look different today. It would be, you know, it would be something on mobile. It would be much more integrated with social platforms, you know, like Instagram or maybe Snapchat. Or maybe Facebook. At the time, we had this key decision back in 2007, which was, okay, Facebook platform had just come out. There were, like, you know, exuberant poking games that were kind of the first games on the Facebook platform. And we saw that, and we thought, you know, the Facebook platform seems too limiting product-wise for us, so we're going to build our own destination site, and we're going to build our own platform and run our games off of that, and that's where the destination will be for users. It turns out the Facebook platform became ubiquitous, and that probably would have been a good decision to build on top of Facebook at the time. Again, you see the success that Zynga had. So looking back, you know, it's always easy to have 20/20 hindsight, right, and to look back and see things differently. But, you know, at the time, we thought we were making the right decisions. I think the concept now, sports rivalries, team rivalries, college rivalries are still powerful social motivators that I think you can still tap into in order to motivate people to do things online. You know, the other interesting thing that I think GoCross Campus had that I still don't see a lot of innovation around is this idea of team-based competition. It's this idea that, you know, if I'm going to play a game or go online to do something competitive, it's a lot more boring if it's more boring if it's just me and I'm interacting and I'm competing against a bunch of strangers. But if I know that myself and my fellow teammates are all Yankees fans, and the people competing against me are all Red Sox fans, I don't even have to know who you are, but I know that you are part of this competitive entity, and I know that me and my cronies are part of, you know, the entity that I believe in and that I support. That is incredibly powerful, right? I just brought the Daybreaker team to the Daily Show yesterday, and it was interesting because one of the things that was brought up was how on the show was how politics has become kind of like a competitive sport. The same way that people feel like, all right, this is my team and I'll stay with them to the end and I will be loyal to my team whether they're doing great or they're doing poorly, right? And no matter what, just because you are a competitive team, I'm going to hate you and I'm going to be opposed to you and everything you're doing is against everything that I believe in, right? And that's kind of how people treat politics as they treat sports, which is incredibly damaging and detrimental to the societal health of the country,
right?
You know, but it's just we have ingrained this idea of competitive sport into our psyche so much that politics just seems like, all right, well, it's two teams, right? They're competing, and you have your team, and I have my team, and let's go, right?
Right.
And they're oftentimes televised in the same way, and the media props them up the same way, and there's that kind of charge that you get. So,
yeah, it's a really interesting analogy.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
This is the risk of making you blush, but we're on quasi-radio here, so it doesn't matter. Brad, you know, who went on to start General Assembly with you, as we said, said this, and it was attributed to your time at PIC Team's GrowCross Campus. Matthew is one of the few truly innovative people I've met in my life. He has the unique ability to look beyond the framing that society puts around most objects and concepts and utilize that ability to be an awesome entrepreneur. Snarky too, okay? Clearly he means snarky as a compliment, but, you know, where's this snarkiness, if you agree with the characterization, been that asset that he speaks of?
Where does that come from? So I think what he's probably referring to is actually something that I think about a lot, which is how do we create more mischief in the world? You know, how can we not look at the status quo and just be okay with that? How can we see society for you know, a set of constructs and a set of rules that people just like us have put in place before? And just because something is structured in a certain way, or that it has been done a certain way before, or that's you know, commonplace, doesn't necessarily mean that is right or that is the best way for something to work. And so, you know, I studied sociology at Yale. This whole kind of all these kind of concepts are always fascinating to me. But I try to look and see, okay, what about the world doesn't seem like it makes sense? Or what could be done differently? How can we, you know, break some rules in a way that isn't going to hurt people, but might and allow people to see things from a wider perspective, see things from a different lens? Steve Jobs had this really good quote that he said in a documentary, which was something to, I'm not going to repeat it exactly, but something to the effect of how he realized at some point that when you look around the world, that everything is kind of just made up by people that are no better than you and similar to you. And once you realize you can poke at it and you can kind of modify it, and then everything is flexible if you want it to be. You just have to realize the fact that the rules and the constructs are just created by people. They're not set in stone by some higher power. Society is created by people, and you are a person in that set of people. So why not play around, and why not break some rules? You know, I'm not here to create, you know, damage. You know, I'm not, you know, a lot of people use this kind of disrupt, and that's not really my MO. I try to build, you know, let's create the new institutions for tomorrow. Let's break down some of the rules, but with the effort of building something new and bringing people together, not tearing people down and destroying things.
Well, you went on to build to truly build something at General Assembly. I mean, it really sort of almost rang helped ring in this new era and this latest tech boom. But it, you already mentioned sort of the difficulty of starting Go Cross Campus with five people, and you started General Assembly with four. So you know,
so shaved off one.
Yeah. Is four the right number?
I think the total number of co-founder or the total number of founders, you know, ideal is probably two or three.
But how did you, I mean, I sort of meant that a little bit cheeky, the right number, but like, I mean, how did you correct some of the errors you made last time? How did you make sure there was more unity in your founding team?
Sure. I think one thing that's very important is kind of keeping to your lanes and really understanding what people are going to be working on and what roles are, and dividing up some parts of the business in a way that makes sense. So, you know, I like to think about it. If you're a co-founder, ideally every single co-founder is working on a set of things that fit three criteria. One is that you're working on something that you really enjoy and that you're passionate about. Two is that you're working on something that is crucial and mission critical to the business. And then three is that you're working on something that you're actually very good at and that you have the skills for, right? And if all of the co-founders, if their scope of work hits all three of those criteria, then you're in a pretty good place. Where I think it gets messy is when you start to overlap too much and there's not a clear understanding of, all right, hey, this is my domain, this is your domain, this is your domain. Obviously, you're going to talk, you're going to discuss, you're going to pull each other in. But having some domains and responsibility over those domains and trusting each other to say, look, you know this better than I do. Let me know when I can help. Let me know what you need. But ultimately, this is your domain. I'm going to let you run with it. It's hard to do, especially in a small team, because everyone wants to be involved in everything and everyone feels like they have an opinion. And when you're all type A leaders, you kind of want to be invested and involved in everything. But it's really important to trust and to have some domain separation so that you're not getting each other's hair all the time.
And yeah, that must be incredibly difficult as everything's exploding at General Assembly, to like kind of maintain that order and those responsibilities when just so much has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a question there.
I mean, now
just,
you know,
sure. I'm just throwing that out there.
Sure. I mean, now, general, you know, when we're a small team, you know, it was tricky. I mean, it's still tricky. There's just new problems. It's funny though, as you go through a company, you know, General Assembly is the first company I've built from four individuals to now 500 plus team members around the world. You know, in 15 cities now across four continents, and it's just been wild and incredible and amazing educational and humbling experience, you know, to go through it all and just to see the company at every stage along the way. But I think, you know, the most important thing that I can really think of with regards to the team and roles is this piece of advice that I got early on, which is hire people who are smarter and better than you at particular things. So if you're bringing on team members who are better than you at particular things, the quality of your employees and the quality of your team members is always going to be going up. And now I can, you know, walk around and look around at the team and realize, wow, this person is doing their job way better than I could do if I were to try to step in and do their job for them. And this person over here is doing their work way better than I could do. And that's a very humbling thing as a co-founder to realize, like, maybe you guys don't need me. I don't know. You know, and granted, you know, everyone's important, and there's a very real role for the co-founders to play, of course. But just to see so much talent in focused areas around the company makes you realize that a successful team is not one where the co-founders are at the top of some anthill looking over their kingdom. You know, that's a vain and approach, and that's hubris, and ultimately that's going to mean that you're, you know, a giant among peons, right? Instead, you want to be, ideally as a co-founder, you want to be humbled by the talent on your team. And if you surround yourself with people who are smarter than you, more capable than you at all these particular areas, then you've built a team of giants, which is the key to success in the long run, I think.
One more question about just getting things right off at the beginning at GA, mm-hmm. which is again in this piece that I'm not sure if I referenced it or not. You published this great piece on failure on your LinkedIn page, and you know you noticed that at GoCross Campus you guys suffered from short-term thinking when raising capital. Mm-hmm. Was that all parties? Was that your investor? Was that your team? You know, what did you do differently that the General Assembly didn't suffer from this kind of short-term thinking?
So raising more money usually takes more work than raising less money. There are people who would argue otherwise, but generally speaking, you know, that's the case, I think. You have to convince more investors to give you more money because your vision is bigger. With GoCross Campus, we were in the final stretch, final like year or so of our company, we were in this kind of constant, we're always raising a little bit. Like, all right, we'll get a little bit of money in here, and we'll get a little bit of money in there, we'll get a little bit of money in there, and we're just always raising little pieces. And what it meant was that we were always fundraising, so it was distracting us from being able to actually focus on the business. You know, you talk to any founder, and they'll all, if they've ever done fundraising, and they'll all tell you that once the fundraising is done, they just have this sigh of relief, because they're like, all right, finally I can go back to focusing on the product and on the business, and I'm not out trying to pitch other people that what I'm doing matters. But I can actually go back to my team and work with my team and actually build the something that matters, you know. And so with General Assembly, you know, we were able to raise. We've raised four rounds now: Series A, B, C, and D. And every time we've raised enough money to say, like, all right, we're done with fundraising. We now have enough cash in the bank where we can grow and we can build. The other nice thing about General Assembly is that it's a real business. We have real revenue coming in. You know, we create educational programs for companies. For individuals, we offer courses and workshops and programs that actually improve people's lives and allow them to make progress in their careers, and they're better off than where they began, and they're willing to spend money to become better off and to receive that sort of personal and professional transformation that they go through at General Assembly. So the business economics are very real, whereas with GoCross Campus and with specifically with GoCross Campus, it was still. We never really had a true revenue model. It was still this, okay, well, we're going to wait till we get a lot of users, and then hopefully we'll figure out ads or charging users or something down the line. And so since then, that's been something, you know, building a true, strong business has been something that's important to me. Like, get the fundamentals right, because if you get the fundamentals right early on, the capital that you raise just helps to accelerate that. But when economic times are not as good, you know, then you still have money coming, you still have revenue coming in, you still have a business that you can build, and you're not completely beholden to outside sources of venture capital when the belts get tightened.
So in terms of, you know, you guys divvying up responsibilities at the beginning, mm-hmm. I mean, now you're in charge of business development. Was that always the case as your job evolved as the company's grown?
Absolutely. I mean, I've tried to Over the course of General Assembly, over the life of the last, you know, of the company over the last 5+ years, I've tried to always think, again, around those three areas. What am I really passionate about? Because what I'm really passionate about doing is what I'm going to be, you know, put my heart and soul into. What does the company really need from me right now? I don't want to be working on something that doesn't matter. And then three, what am I good at? What can I bring real expertise and real skills at to the table that, you know, I can be better at than anyone else, right? And so over the years, it's meant a number of different things. You know, when we first started General Assembly, it meant a lot of community building. It meant a lot of bringing our inaugural members, selecting and curating and cultivating our inaugural membership into the community back when we were doing co-working back in 2011. And then it was starting to produce events and start to, you know, organize hackathons and work with partners to bring in speakers and conferences and hackathons and whatnot. And then it turned into partnerships and business development. And then it became, you know, starting our enterprise business, which was really very experimental early on. And now our enterprise business makes up a good chunk of the business as a whole. And it's a whole big team now, you know, and I'm no longer involved in the enterprise team day to day, but it continues to thrive and it continues to go on. And then so now, you know, I spend a lot of my time kind of focused on three areas of General Assembly. One is working with our marketing team on big partnerships and bringing in partners and interesting people and interesting opportunities to the table so we can grow our audience and expand the kind of people that we touch. Number two is I spend a lot of time supporting and growing our social impact team. So about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, we actually started a scholarship program called Opportunity Fund, which was also initially an experiment, but has now raised quite a bit of philanthropic capital, all of which we are putting into scholarships for underrepresented groups and lower-income individuals. So we now have scholarships, full-ride scholarships that we can provide for military veterans, for individuals from low-income backgrounds, for individuals from underrepresented groups, and other you know, disadvantaged populations, that we can bring them into General Assembly. We match one for one every single scholarship that we raise outside capital for, which is a pretty cool thing. I think it's a noble thing. And so what that means is that we can really start to diversify our students and start to really bring in people into the tech world and give them the opportunity to pursue a future in the digital economy and give them the opportunity to pursue their passions, no matter what their economic background is. You know, so that anyone who's willing to work hard and follow their passions can have a chance pursuing, you know, work they love. So that's a big area of passion for mine. And then the third area that I focus on is supporting our alumni community and really think about how do we build General Assembly, specifically our alumni and their engagement with us and with each other over the long haul, so that decades from now, you know, the General Assembly alumni community is a powerful force in the world, is a great connected community, supporting each other, helping each other, you know, hopefully always having access to General Assembly, maybe coming to take a class, maybe tapping into our hiring network, maybe hiring grads out of a course they took 10 years ago, you know, that's maybe been revamped or something. So those are kind of the three areas of focus that I spent a lot of my time on.
So, you know, when I was doing my research for the show, I saw all these, like, you know, tremendous brand names that you guys have, you know, the GAS partnerships with, and some of them are really interesting and innovative. Encourage people to go out there and check it out. But, like, was there a moment where, I don't know who the name might be, but where you were like, wow, we had a partnership with them, and that is really legitimizing. Like, who was the first big fish you guys landed? Mm-hmm. Was it just like a, wow, we're for real now?
Wow. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one of our earliest partners was the City of New York, the Economic Development Corporation, which is part of the New York City government. And they actually gave us a grant very early on, right before we launched, to help us get started. And I remember it was just such a powerful validating force. You know, this is 2010 when we were finishing construction, starting to build the community. And then we actually launched our campus in New York in early 2011. But that was a pretty powerful, you know, validation for us. It's like, wow, you know, here we are. I'd moved to New York a year and a half before. I'd moved to New York from out of college. First time living in New York in summer of 2009. And then just a little over a year later, I have the City of New York giving me and my co-founders a grant to start this community hub and educational campus to support entrepreneurship and the future startups of New York City, which is like, wow. Mm-hmm. Doing something right, like, okay, you know, the city believes in us, let's go. You know, it was still early days then. Another great partner that we had early on, which was very, you know, validating for us, was our first enterprise education client was General Electric. And we always really liked, you know, the state of, okay, General Electric and General Assembly, like, surely they should work together. Yeah, that makes sense.
General Dynamics, General Motors, General Mills.
Yeah, get them all, yeah. You know. And I remember it was fun because early on, you know, we got to really be creative and innovative with, all right, we're going to rethink enterprise education. You know, corporate training typically sucks, you know, as an experience, and it's kind of lost in the dark ages somewhere. And so we thought, all right, how can we move education for big companies? You know, people within working in big Fortune 500s, they're people too. You know, they're hungry, they're interested, you know, they want to learn, they want to get better at their jobs, just as our, you know, just as our kind of consumer students are. And so I remember when we worked with General Electric, we were building out this week-long program for them, and I decided, okay, Thursday evening, we're going to have a special surprise. They didn't know, and these are a whole bunch of General Electric executives from all over the world who were in town spending their week with us at General Assembly. And so Thursday afternoon, after our kind of formal classroom programs are done, we take them outside and out parked on Broadway at 21st and Broadway, right outside of our campus, right in the middle of Flatiron District in Manhattan, there's a yellow school bus. And I had hired a yellow school bus to take them from the General Assembly campus, this school that they were going to. They get on the school bus and like, wow, I haven't been on a school bus in decades, you know, but they get on a school bus and we drive them downtown, where was the restaurant? To a restaurant that actually does not exist anymore. A very New York thing. but it was this cool, really vibey, like, underground restaurant. And we took them there for, like, a kind of celebratory dinner, you know, because they're almost done with the week. And it was really just nice to spend time with them and get them to kind of open up as people, not just as executives with each other and with us. And it was a nice community building time. And then at the end of the night, then they get back in the school bus and we took them back up to their hotel, you know. So those sort of things was just, I remember that was a surreal but beautiful moment to think, wow, you know, one of the biggest companies in the world, General Electric, here they are spending time with us, working with us, and we get to put them all in a yellow school bus and kind of like, you know, create an experience that we think is going to be meaningful, you know. And I guarantee that no other, you know, corporate training provider, you know, put their executive client in a yellow school bus.
And they're, of course, delighted by it, right?
Totally. And they're just like, wow, this is so fun. And like, it makes us, it just, you know, it brings a humanity into a space that might not otherwise have it, you know, which is something, which is a big thing that we think we've thought a lot about at General Assembly. You know, it's not just about the utility and it's not just about the skills that we can give people, you know, teaching people how to code or giving them, turning them into UX professionals, but how can we also inspire them? How can we also give them the opportunity to dream big, build the future, think about their careers, not just the next promotion or their next leveling up, but like, who do they want to become? You know, what's their passion? What's their purpose in life? And how can we help them find that and then accelerate them down that path? You know, we don't have a prescribed path for all of our students and all of our partners. We want to help them find that. We want to give them the tools, the inspiration, and the opportunity to pursue whatever it is that they love, whatever they're passionate about.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Andrew Yang, the VFA founder, he's fond of talking about how like founders shape companies, but companies also shape founders. And I think that's a really interesting, you know, idea. You know, how has General Assembly changed the person you are, the manager or the person you are?
General Assembly has definitely made me. It has been the most educational experience that I've had in my life. I mean, Yale was very educational. This is educational in a whole different way. It's been, you know, 5+ years of really immersive. Experiential training and what it's like to build a company and what it's like to grow a team. I think specifically, it has made me realize that any company that I start in the future, I want to really have an impact in the world. I want to really be something that moves people forward, that moves the world forward. You know, I'm not interested in building companies that are just out to make money or just out to you know, turn a buck. We have limited time on this earth. We have, you know, only so much bandwidth, only so much resource, only so many resources. So, you know, it is just, it has given me this real sense of purpose that, okay, you know, General Assembly, I've seen General Assembly transform people's lives. You know, I mean, we've served hundreds of thousands of students now. We have tens of thousands of alumni who've taken one of our long form or full time courses. And there's just so many stories of personal transformation and stories of how General Assembly has fundamentally impacted people's lives for the better. And that's just been so rewarding, you know? And I realized that being an entrepreneur, the really truly rewarding parts of it are about seeing other people thrive, whether it's team members, whether it's your customers or clients, whether it's your students. The joy is in that. The joy is in moving the world forward and empowering other people and seeing other people thrive and become better people. The joy is not in an exit. The joy is not in making a lot of money. And so I think it's really made a big impact on me and just giving me that deep, deep sense of purpose of anything that I do for my career moving forward now, I want to be toward like a destination of positive world impact and on improving people's lives and on making a difference in the world, because otherwise, you know, I'll be wasting my time and you know, bandwidth on this planet.
You're obviously still passionate about General Assembly. You're still, you know, there, you know, committing your time to it. Mm-hmm. But you know, you've managed to to take on a variety of other projects, and I guess the highest profile of which is Daybreaker. Like, what was the impulse that led you to Daybreaker, I guess, as a concept, but also what made you feel like, hey, I can take on building another community in a very, you know, just a, seems to be like a lot of time and effort would have to go into building a separate business with GA still growing and being so exciting. Like what was the thought process both in starting the company as a concept, but also in terms of like your budget of time?
Sure. Definitely a good question. You know, I would definitely not have been able to start Daybreaker earlier on in GA's history. You know, now General Assembly is, it's thriving. We have a fantastic team. We have a lot of people involved. Daybreaker really began as a social experiment, as an art project. It was not, when we started it, we didn't intend it to be another startup or be a company.
Was it supposed to be a one and done?
Like, it was supposed to be an experiment. It was supposed to be an event. It was supposed to be an experience, and a way to try something new. So, you know, it began. I was working on General Assembly full time, and I came to my friend Radha, who's my Daybreaker co-founder. You know, who's also been a serial entrepreneur and a longtime community builder and lover of experiences. And both of us have done a lot of event production and experience design over the years. So it's always been a passion. And I was talking about this idea about how, you know, I'd kind of grown frustrated. Together, we talked about how we'd grown frustrated with a lot of traditional nightlife and entertainment in New York, and how it seemed like, you know, this idea of, you know, music and entertainment and dancing were so necessarily attributed and associated with drugs and alcohol and late nights and self-destructive behavior and dark energy and kind of dirty nightclubs and all this kind of negative stuff. And we thought, well, why, that doesn't have to be the case. Both of us were, you know, have been longtime burners. We've been going to Burning Man for, I think, this will be my fifth year consecutive in a row. And so, you know, that festival in particular and the experience there and the kind of massive levels of creativity and of openness and of generosity and of positivity that you get to experience out there were powerful in just showing, you know, both of us, I think, what people are capable of and how people are capable of interacting. And so we're having this conversation and we thought, well, why does like a great, you know, dance party have to happen just at night? What if we could create the most positive, the most energetic, the most social, and the most healthy way to start your day rather than the way to end your night? And we thought, well, if we're going to create the best possible way to start your day with a dance party, we don't want to serve any alcohol because you're going to work afterwards. So, you know, nobody wants to drink. Instead, we'll serve coffee and we'll serve juice and we'll serve smoothies and coconut water and green juice. And so you're only putting healthy, good things in your body. And really, we realized we could actually do this in such a way that marries the world of health and wellness. It's going to have 21st century of health and wellness, which is getting a lot of interest, especially from young people wanting to live better lives. They're more conscious about what they put in their bodies. They're more conscious about how they treat themselves. And then this other world of this growing world of experiential entertainment, and of people realizing, young people especially, people realizing that experiences are the new luxuries. You know, we want experiences more than we want stuff. You know, more than we want possessions. And so that, okay, what if we can create an incredibly powerful and artistic and transformative experience in the morning, so that it energizes you and starts off your day in the best way possible, and then you go to work and you feel totally awake and totally alive. It's more fun than going to the gym. It's still a workout, but it's also social and artistic and creative and allows you to self-express and allows you to kind of like check in with yourself and almost kind of be a kid again. It like removes the rules and removes the status quo. It allows you to kind of have a little bit of mischief right in the morning, and then you come out and you're like, oh, I feel just so much more light and just more joyful, and I'm awake, and now I'm going to bring that energy and that positivity and that creativity into my day. You know, and so we did the first one back in December of 2013. Again, it was a total experiment. We just said, let's just do one of these and see what happens. So we did one. We invited our friends. 180 people bought tickets and showed up at 6:30 in the morning. And it was just the most magical, amazing, positive experience. And nobody was drunk. There was no alcohol. And it was over like 8:30 or 9. And everyone came out, and it was daylight, and everyone went off to work, and we just were getting tons and tons of positive feedback and reviews, and people said they had the best day, and they felt so alive and so happy. And so we thought, all right, well, let's do another one. Let's do one in a couple months. We did another one. We had even more people come. We did a different venue, different DJs. You know, we always have live music and performers and musicians and dancers, and it's always this kind of surprising. It's part dance party, part, you know, fitness experience, and part immersive theater sort of thing. And so we just kept iterating on it, and over time the events became bigger and bigger and bigger, and we realized, hey, we actually have something real here. This is a community, this is a brand, this is a powerful experience for people. And so it became a very large side project for both of us. And we started to, you know, expand the team, bring people on. I got some apprentices, some interns, and started to grow the team. And so now, fast forward to today, we have several full-time team members. We have a bunch of part-time team members, producers in over 10 cities around the world who are now producing Daybreaker events under the Daybreak organization. And it's just been this experiment turned movement that's been pretty incredible.
I hate to date myself with a reference here, but it almost sounds like Field of Dreams there. Like, you know, just kind of like people just started lining up and
if
showing up.
If you build
it,
they will come.
Yeah. But I mean, it's interesting. You talk about like the kind of this force of darkness in, you know, and certainly an exclusionary force in New York nightlife and the like. I mean, I'm too stubborn a person to wait in line for anything. I'm just I don't need this.
Yeah.
But I mean, how do you, when you create a community, there's also a loss of control, right? Like you bring all these, and they own the community, and these people are coming back because they feel that sense of ownership. But how do you continuously have the imprint and make sure you keep those forces of darkness at bay?
Yeah. So it's probably a bunch of things there. I think one, the focus on no alcohol, I think, is a big one because it ensures that people are coming there for the right reasons. You know, it's also really early in the morning and you have to buy a ticket. So there's a few filters. So if you buy a ticket, you wake up really early, you put on your workout gear, a lot of people come in costume. So a lot of creativity.
Phenomenal pictures on the Instagram.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. It's definitely a photogenic experience. But you come, it's like, okay, if you're waking up this early, you've bought your ticket and you're not there to drink, then surely you're there for like something pretty awesome, you know? And a lot of the way it spreads is really word of mouth, you know. So that's one. The other is we try to interact with our community a lot, you know. And it's this realization that the community can only be guided and kind of pushed a little bit, you know, by us. But ultimately, the community is the sum of the parts. The community is the people who feel drawn to it. And so if we can create an experience where the music and the words and the run of show and the magic is something that is attractive to the kind of people that we want, then we, you know, continue doing that. And we listen too. If, you know, people say like, hey, you know, this part really like bothered me, or you know, this part really I just wasn't feeling, we'll listen to our community and adjust and adapt, you know, while still trying to keep a creative vision. A few other, you know, considerations that we have around on building a strong community are, you know, this idea of giving karma in order to get karma. So, and I've done this throughout my professional life, you know, both with General Assembly and Daybreaker and everything, as much as I can. Just try to be as useful as possible, not asking for things in return. So if any time that I can make an introduction to two people who should meet each other and who are interested, I'll do so. Any time that I can give advice or offer insight into something, if someone's asking me about a particular thing that I have some expertise in, I'm happy to do that. I just try to be as helpful professionally in terms of my you know, network and my personal community as possible. And ultimately what that means is that then, you know, when I go on Facebook or something and say, hey, we need a trombonist for next week's event.
How many times have I gone on Facebook and said that?
Yeah. So the very first Daybreaker, like the night before, I think our trumpet player dropped out or something. We needed another one. So I went on and said, hey, I really need a trumpet player, you know. And I got all these posts within like hours, you know, people recommending, you know, people. So that sort of thing, like that serendipity is very much a part of community building. You know, when you're good to people, when you're good to community and you don't ask for anything in return, when you do need something, you know, people come out in droves.
Are you able to, I mean, now Daybreaker's in many different cities and it's many different events. I signed up for the list. I was tempted to go to the, you now have an evening event every once in a while, I think.
I was
invited to one on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Thursday. It was our first evening experience.
Thursday, so, there you go.
So, okay. You know, the idea is, okay, well, if Daybreaker's kind of reimagine the morning, then Dusk, which is our evening experience now, which we're going to start to take to other cities, you know, the intention there is to kind of take back happy hour and to create an experience after work in the evenings that, again, is still alcohol-free, but that is transformative and magic and positive and social you know, all of the kind of the daybreaker things,
right.
But allowing you to then go off and not stay out super late, but still have an amazing time and a conscious experience after work.
Right. It's perfect for a guy like me who goes to bed at 9:30. Are you still able to, like, do you still try and go to these as many events as you can? I mean, there's so many events.
We're in now over 10 cities around the world. So I can't go to all the ones that are not in New York unless I'm traveling in there. You know, we have good teams in all the cities. I go to all of our events in New York, and I'm obviously very involved in all of them. And now, you know, it's a lot of it comes down to time management, and obviously, you know, that's something I can always be getting better at. You know, I think most people can, but I really try to, you know, manage my time. So I'm still spending a lot of time on General Assembly, and I'm very, very involved in there and a lot of the projects and areas that I mentioned. But I'm also spending, you know, a pretty significant amount of time building Daybreaker and growing the team and supporting a whole bunch of different aspects to the company there. And, you know, I kind of get my early stage startup fix building Daybreaker, which is a small team and scrappy and very entrepreneurial and very young and still building a lot of the pieces. But then also, you know, get to do that, but then also get to work on General Assembly and operate at scale and, you know, work on things that are, again, transforming people's lives. You know, I think I do in the joy. If you zoom out a little bit, both General Assembly and Daybreaker are meaningful communities that matter to people, that are very values driven, that are both about personal transformation, that are both about moving people's lives forward and allowing them to become better versions of themselves through the creation of meaningful experiences. With General Assembly, those are educational experiences. With Daybreaker, those are, you know, immersive music and dance experiences. But either way, people have a strong affinity to these experiences and to each other in the community of people who participate. And it's just so rewarding to see how much people love both.
And you're talking with such visible excitement mm-hmm. about Daybreaker as like a movement and doing something meaningful. Mm-hmm. But is there still, are there still defined business goals behind that?
Absolutely.
Revenue targets?
Absolutely. And, you know? I mean, we see Daybreaker as first and foremost a community and as a, you know, it's a lifestyle as well. And we're working on aspects to do that as well. We're launching apparel soon. We're launching a content channel soon, which will have all sorts of fun ways to kind of live the Daybreaker lifestyle every single day. You know, but you know, we're also building it in a sustainable way, and we haven't taken a dime of outside funding. You know, it's entirely you know, grown through you know, ticket sales and revenue. You know, we don't charge. There's no alcohol. You know, once you're inside, all the healthy beverages and the smoothies and the salads and snacks and everything, that's all free. So, you know, the margins are different, right? You know, a lot, if you look at a nightclub or something, they're making a ticket price from a concert, they're also making alcohol sales. We don't get any alcohol sales. It's not a revenue driver. But we are still building this as a sustainable business. You know, we want Daybreaker to be around really in the long term, and for this to be a movement that exists all over the world, and for this to be a, you know, massive global community of people who have woken up, you know, literally and figuratively, and want to live life differently and with more positivity, with more creativity and more mindfulness, you know, around the world. And that needs to be done, you know, in a sustainable way where the finances make sense, as well as, the, you know, how we interact with the people. Making sense.
I mean, it sounds like a ton of fun, and I'd really actually like to attend one when my schedule allows. We're talking about time crunches,
sure.
And indeed we have a time crunch now. And I've got a half dozen questions for you, so we'll have to have you back sometime in the future when the Daybreaker story continues to evolve and develop. But thanks so much for being here, Matt. It was really interesting, and good luck with everything.
Sure. Thank you. Good to be here. Hopefully we'll see you at Daybreaker soon.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.